special friend was more than common. He was a byword. He was half an Airedale and half a retriever, and the worst half of both. Whenever there was a fight in the road, he would be sure to be in the thick of it. He was always getting into trouble with the postman or the policeman, and there was nothing he loved better than sniffing about in drains or garbage tins. He was, in fact, the talk of the whole street, and more than one person had been heard to say, thankfully, that they were glad he was not their dog. But Andrew loved him, and was continually on the watch for him. Sometimes they had only time to exchange a sniff in the park, but on luckier occasions, though these were very rare, they would have long talks at the gate. From his friend, Andrew heard all the town gossip, and you could see by the rude way in which the other dog laughed as he told it that it wasn't very complimentary. Then suddenly Miss Lark's voice would be heard calling from a window, and the other dog would get up, loll out his tongue at Miss Lark, wink at Andrew and wander off, waving his hindquarters as he went, just to show that he didn't care. Andrew, of course, was never allowed outside the gate unless he went with Miss Lark for a walk in the park or with one of the maids to have his toes manicured. Imagine, then, the surprise of Jane and Michael when they saw Andrew all alone, careering past them through the park, with his ears back and his tail up as though he were on the track of a tiger. Mary Poppins pulled the perambulator up with a jerk, in case Andrew, in his wild flight, should upset it and the twins, and Jane and Michael screamed at him as he passed. "Hi, Andrew, where's your overcoat?" cried Michael, trying to make a high, windy voice like Miss Lark's. "Andrew, you naughty little boy!" said Jane, and her voice, because she was a girl, was much more like Miss Lark's. But Andrew just looked at them both very haughtily and barked sharply in the direction of Mary Poppins. "Yap, yap!" said Andrew several times, very quickly. "Let me see. I think it's the first on your right and second house on the left-hand side," said Mary Poppins. "Yap," said Andrew. "No, no garden, only a backyard. Gates usually open." Andrew barked again. "I'm not sure," said Mary Poppins, "but I should think so. Generally goes home at tea time." Andrew flung back his head and set off again at a gallop. Jane's eyes and Michael's were round as saucers with surprise. "What was he saying?" they demanded breathlessly, both together. "Just passing the time of day," said Mary Poppins, and shut her mouth tightly, as though she did not intend any more words to escape from it. John and Barbara gurgled from their perambulator. "He wasn't," said Michael. "He couldn't have been," said Jane. "Well, you know best, of course, as usual," said Mary Poppins haughtily. "He must have been asking you where somebody lived, I'm sure he must," Michael began. "Well, if you know, why bother to ask me?" said Mary Poppins, sniffing. "I'm no dictionary." "Oh, Michael," said Jane, "she'll never tell us if you talk like that." "Mary Poppins, do say what Andrew was saying to you, please."
"Ask him. He knows, Mr. Know-all," said Mary Poppins, nodding her head scornfully at Michael.
"Oh, no, I don't. I promise I don't, Mary Poppins. Do tell."
"3:30, tea time," said Mary Poppins, and she wheeled the perambulator round and shut her mouth tight again as though it were a trapdoor. She did not say another word all the way home. Jane dropped behind with Michael. "It's your fault," she said. "Now I'll never know."
"I don't care," said Michael, and he began to push his scooter very quickly. "I don't want to know."
But he did want to know, very badly indeed. And, as it turned out, he and Jane and everybody else knew all about it before tea time.
Just as they were about to cross the road to their own house, they heard loud cries coming from next door, and there they saw a curious sight. Miss Lark's two maids were rushing wildly about the garden, looking under bushes and up into the trees, as people do who have lost their most valuable possession. And there was Robertson I from number 17, busily wasting his time by poking at the gravel on Miss Lark's path with a broom, as though he expected to find the missing treasure under a pebble. Miss Lark herself was running about in her garden, waving her arms and calling,
"Andrew, Andrew, oh, he's lost! My darling boy is lost! We must send for the police! I must see the Prime Minister! Andrew is lost! Oh, dear! Oh, dear!"
"Oh, poor Miss Lark," said Jane, hurrying across the road. She could not help feeling sorry, because Miss Lark looked so upset.
But it was Michael who really comforted Miss Lark. Just as he was going in at the gate of number 17, he looked down the lane, and there he saw,
Why, there's Andrew, Miss Lark. See, down there, just turning Admiral Boom's corner.
Where? Where? Show me, said Miss Lark breathlessly, and she peered in the direction in which Michael was pointing. And there, sure enough, was Andrew, walking as slowly and as casually as though nothing in the world was the matter. And beside him waltzed a huge dog that seemed to be half an Airedale and half a retriever, and the worst half of both.
Oh, what a relief, said Miss Lark, sighing loudly. What a load off my mind.
Mary Poppins and the children waited in the lane outside Miss Lark's gate. Miss Lark herself and her two maids leant over the fence. Robertson I, resting from his labours, propped himself up with his broom handle, and all of them watched in silence the return of Andrew. He and his friend marched sedately up to the group, whisking their tails jauntily and keeping their ears well cocked, and you could tell by the look in Andrew's eye that whatever he meant business.
"Dreadful dog!" said Miss Lark, looking at Andrew's companion. "Shoo! Shoo! Go home!"
she cried. But the dog just sat down on the pavement and scratched his right ear with his left leg and yawned.
"Go away! Go away! Shoo, I say!"
said Miss Lark, waving her arms angrily at the dog.
"And you, Andrew," she went on, "come indoors this minute, going out like that all alone and without your overcoat. I'm very displeased with you."
Andrew barked lazily, but did not move.
"What do you mean, Andrew? Come in at once," said Miss Lark.
Andrew barked again.
"He says," put in Mary Poppins, "that he's not coming in."
Miss Lark turned and regarded her haughtily.
"How do you know what my dog says, may I ask? Of course he will come in."
Andrew, however, merely shook his head and gave one or two low growls. "He won't," said Mary Poppins, "not unless his friend comes too."
"Stuff and nonsense," said Miss Lark crossly. "That can't be what he says. As if I could have a great hulking mongrel like that inside my gate."
Andrew yapped three or four times. "He says he means it," said Mary Poppins. "And what's more, he'll go and live with his friend, unless his friend is allowed to come and live with him."
"Oh, Andrew, you can't. You can't, really. After all I've done for you and everything."
Miss Lark was nearly weeping. Andrew barked and turned away. The other dog got up.
"Oh, he does mean it," cried Miss Lark. "I see he does. He's going away."
She sobbed a moment into her handkerchief. Then she blew her nose and said,
"Very well, then, Andrew, I give in. This common dog can stay, on condition, of course, that he sleeps in the coal cellar."
"He insists, ma'am, that that won't do. His friend must have a silk cushion just like his and sleep in your room too, otherwise he will go and sleep in the coal cellar with his friend," said Mary Poppins.
"Andrew, how could you?" moaned Miss Lark. "I shall never consent to such a thing."
Andrew looked as though he were preparing to depart. So did the other dog.
"Oh, he's leaving me!" shrieked Miss Lark. "Very well, then, Andrew. It will be as you wish. He shall sleep in my room, but I shall never be the same again. Never, never. Such a common dog." She wiped her streaming eyes and went on. "I should never have thought it of you, Andrew, but I'll say no more, no matter what I think. And this creature, I shall have to call Whiff or Stray or..."
At that, the other dog looked at Miss Lark very indignantly, and Andrew barked loudly. "They say you must call him Willoughby, and nothing else," said Mary Poppins, "Willoughby being his name."
"Willoughby? What a name! Worse and worse!" said Miss Lark despairingly. "What is he saying now?"
For Andrew was barking again. "He says that if he comes back, you are never to make him wear overcoats or go to the hairdresser's again. That's his last word," said Mary Poppins. There was a pause.
"Very well," said Miss Lark at last. "But I warn you, Andrew, if you catch your death of cold, don't blame me."
And with that she turned and walked haughtily up the steps, sniffing away the last of her tears. Andrew cocked his head towards Willoughby as if to say, "Come on." And the two of them waltzed side by side slowly up the garden path, waving their tails like banners, and followed Miss Lark into the house. "He isn't a nincompoop, after all, you see," said Jane, as they went upstairs to the nursery and tea. "No," agreed Michael.
But how do you think Mary Poppins knew?
I don't know, said Jane. And she'll never, never tell us. I am sure of that.
Chapter 5. The Dancing Cow. Jane, with her head tied up in Mary Poppins's bandana handkerchief, was in bed with earache. What does it feel like? Michael wanted to know. Like guns going off inside my head, said Jane. Cannons? No, pop guns. Oh, said Michael, and he almost wished he could have earache too. It sounded so exciting. Shall I tell you a story out of one of the books? Said Michael, going to the bookshelf.
No, I just couldn't bear it, said Jane, holding her ear with her hand.
Well, shall I sit at the window and tell you what is happening outside?
Yes, do, said Jane.
So Michael sat all the afternoon on the window seat, telling her everything that occurred in the lane, and sometimes his accounts were very dull, and sometimes very exciting. There's Admiral Boom, he said once. He has come out of his gate, and he is hurrying down the lane. Here he comes. His nose is redder than ever, and he's wearing a top hat. Now he is passing next door.
Is he saying blast my gizzard? Inquired Jane.
I can't hear. I expect so. There's Miss Lark's second housemaid in Miss Lark's garden, and Robertson I is in our garden, sweeping up the leaves and looking at her over the fence. He is sitting down now, having a rest.
He has a weak heart, said Jane.
How do you know?
He told me. He said his doctor said he was to do as little as possible. And I heard Daddy say if Robertson I does what his doctor told him to, he'll sack him.
Oh, how it bangs and bangs, said Jane, clutching her ear again.
Hello, said Michael excitedly from the window.
What is it? Cried Jane, sitting up. Do tell me.
Very extraordinary thing. There's a cow down in the lane, said Michael, jumping up and down on the window seat. A cow? A real cow right in the middle of a town? How funny.
Mary Poppins, said Jane. There's a cow in the lane, Michael says.
Yes, and it's walking very slowly, putting its head over every gate and looking round as though it had lost something.
I wish I could see it, said Jane mournfully.
Look, said Michael, pointing downwards as Mary Poppins came to the window. A cow! Isn't that funny? Mary Poppins gave a quick, sharp glance down into the lane. She started with surprise.
Certainly not, she said, turning to Jane and Michael. It's not funny at all. I know that cow. She was a great friend of my mother's, and I'll thank you to speak politely to her.
She smoothed her apron and looked at them both very severely.
Have you known her long? Inquired Michael gently, hoping that if he was particularly polite, he would hear something more about the cow.
"Since before she saw the king," said Mary Poppins.
"And when was that?" asked Jane in a soft, encouraging voice.
Mary Poppins stared into space, her eyes fixed upon something that they could not see. Jane and Michael held their breath, waiting.
"It was long ago," said Mary Poppins in a brooding, storytelling voice. She paused, as though she were remembering events that happened hundreds of years before that time. Then she went on dreamily, still gazing into the middle of the room, but without seeing anything.
The Red Cow, that's the name she went by. And very important and prosperous she was too, so my mother said. She lived in the best field in the whole district, a large one, full of buttercups the size of saucers and dandelions standing up in it like soldiers. Every time she ate the head off one soldier, another grew up in its place, with a green military coat and a yellow busby.
She had lived there always. She often told my mother that she couldn't remember the time when she hadn't lived in that field. Her world was bounded by green hedges and the sky, and she knew nothing of what lay beyond these. The Red Cow was very respectable. She always behaved like a perfect lady, and she knew what was what. To her, a thing was either black or white. There was nothing in between. Dandelions were either sweet or sour. There were never any moderately nice ones. She led a very busy life. Her mornings were taken up in giving lessons to the red calf, her daughter, and in the afternoon she taught the little one deportment and mooing and all the things a really well-brought-up calf should know. Then they had their supper, and the red cow showed the red calf how to select a good blade of grass from a bad one, and when her child had gone to sleep at night she would go into a corner of the field and chew the cud and think her own quiet thoughts. All her days were exactly the same. One red calf grew up and went away, and another came in its place. And it was natural that the red cow should imagine that her life would always be the same as it had always been. Indeed, she felt that she could ask for nothing better than for all her days to be alike till she came to the end of them. But at the very moment she was thinking these thoughts, adventure, as she afterwards told my mother, was stalking her. It came upon her one night when the stars themselves looked like dandelions in the sky, and the moon a great daisy among the stars. On this night, long after the red calf was asleep, the red cow stood up suddenly and began to dance. She danced wildly and beautifully and in perfect time, though she had no music to go by. Sometimes it was a polka, sometimes a Highland fling, and sometimes a special dance that she made up out of her own head. And in between these dances, she would curtsy and make sweeping bows and knock her head against the dandelions. "Dear me," said the red cow to herself, as she began on a sailor's hornpipe. "What an extraordinary thing! I always thought dancing improper, but it can't be since I myself am dancing, for I am a model cow." And she went on dancing, and thoroughly enjoying herself. At last, however, she grew tired, and decided that she had danced enough, and that she would go to sleep. But, to her great surprise, she found that she could not stop dancing. When she went to lie down beside the red calf, her legs would not let her. They went on capering and prancing, and of course carrying her with them. Round and round the field she went, leaping and waltzing and stepping on tiptoe. "Dear me," she murmured at intervals with a ladylike accent, "how very peculiar." But she couldn't stop. In the morning she was still dancing, and the red calf had to take its breakfast of dandelions all by itself because the red cow could not remain still enough to eat. All through the day she danced, up and down the meadow, and round the meadow, with the red calf mooing piteously behind her. When the second night came, and she was still at it, and still could not stop, she grew very worried, and at the end of a week of dancing she was nearly distracted. "I must go and see the king about it," she decided, shaking her head. So she kissed her red calf and told it to be good. Then she turned and danced out of the meadow and went to tell the king. She danced all the way, snatching little sprays of green food from the hedges as she went, and every eye that saw her stared with astonishment. But none of them were more astonished than the red cow herself. At last she came to the palace where the king lived. She pulled the bell rope with her mouth, and when the gate opened, she danced through it and up the broad garden path till she came to the flight of steps that led to the king's throne. Upon this the king was sitting, busily making a new set of laws. His secretary was writing them down in a little red notebook, one after another, as the king thought of them. There were courtiers and ladies-in-waiting everywhere, all very gorgeously dressed, and all talking at once.
"How many have I made today?" asked the king, turning to the secretary. The secretary counted the laws he had written down in the red notebook.
72, Your Majesty," he said, bowing low and taking care not to trip over his quill pen, which was a very large one.
"Not bad for an hour's work,"
said the king, looking very pleased with himself.
"That's enough for today."
He stood up and arranged his ermine cloak very tastefully.
"Order my coach. I must go to the barber's," he said magnificently.
It was then that he noticed the red cow approaching. He sat down again and took up his sceptre.
"What have we here, ho?"
he demanded, as the red cow danced to the foot of the steps.
"A cow, Your Majesty," she answered simply.
"I can see that," said the king. "I still have my eyesight. But what do you want? Be quick, because I have an appointment with the barber at 10. He won't wait for me longer than that, and I must have my hair cut. And for goodness sake, stop jigging and jagging about like that," he added irritably. "It makes me quite giddy."
"Quite giddy?" echoed all the courtiers, staring. "That's just my trouble, Your Majesty. I can't stop," said the red cow piteously.
"Can't stop? Nonsense," said the king furiously. "Stop at once! I, the king, command you! Stop at once! The king commands you!" cried all the courtiers.
The red cow made a great effort. She tried so hard to stop dancing that every muscle and every rib stood out like mountain ranges all over her. But it was no good.
She just went on dancing at the foot of the king's steps. "I have tried, Your Majesty, and I can't. I've been dancing now for 7 days running, and I've had no sleep and very little to eat. A white thorn spray or two, that's all, so I've come to ask your advice."
Very curious,"
said the king, pushing the crown on one side and scratching his head. "Very curious," said the courtiers, scratching their heads too.
"What does it feel like?" asked the king.
"Funny," said the red cow, "and yet..." She paused, as if choosing her words. "It's rather a pleasant feeling, too, as if laughter were running up and down inside me."
"Extraordinary," said the king,
and he put his chin on his hand and stared at the red cow, pondering on what was the best thing to do. Suddenly, he sprang to his feet and said, "Good gracious!"
"What is it?" cried all the courtiers.
"Why, don't you see?" said the king, getting very excited and dropping his scepter. "What an idiot I was not to have noticed it before! And what idiots you were!" He turned furiously upon the courtiers. "Don't you see that there's a fallen star caught on a horn?" "So there is!" cried the courtiers, as they all suddenly noticed the star for the first time. And as they looked, it seemed to them that the star grew brighter.
"That's what's wrong," said the king. "Now, you courtiers had better pull it off, so that this, lady can stop dancing and have some breakfast. It's the star, madam, that is making you dance," he said to the red cow. "Now come along, you!"
And he motioned to the chief courtier, who presented himself smartly before the red cow and began to tug at the star. It would not come off. The chief courtier was joined by one after another of the other courtiers, until at last there was a long chain of them, each holding the man in front of him by the waist, and a tug of war began between the courtiers and the star. "Mind my head," entreated the red cow.
"Pull harder,"
roared the king. They pulled harder. They pulled until their faces were red as raspberries. They pulled till they could pull no longer, and all fell back, one on top of the other. The star did not move. It remained firmly fixed to the horn. Said the king.
"Secretary, look in the encyclopedia and see what it says about cows with stars on their horns."
The secretary knelt down and began to crawl under the throne. Presently he emerged, carrying a large green book, which was always kept there in case the king wanted to know anything. He turned the pages. "There's nothing at all, Your Majesty, except the story of the cow who jumped over the moon, and you know all about that." The king rubbed his chin, because that helped him to think. He sighed irritably and looked at the red cow.
"All I can say," he said, "is that you'd better try that too."
"Try what?" said the red cow.
"Jumping over the moon. Might have an effect. Worth trying anyway."
"Me?" said the red cow, with an outraged stare.
"Yes! You! Who else?"
said the king impatiently. He was anxious to get to the barber's.
"Sire," said the red cow, "I beg you to remember that I am a decent, respectable animal and have been taught from my infancy that jumping was no occupation for a lady."
The king stood up and shook his scepter at her.
"Madam," he said, "you came here for my advice and I have given it to you. Do you want to go on dancing forever? Do you want to go hungry forever? Do you want to go sleepless forever?"
The red cow thought of the lush, sweet taste of dandelions. She thought of meadow grass and how soft it was to lie on. She thought of her weary, capering legs and how nice it would be to rest them. And she said to herself, perhaps, just for once, it wouldn't matter and nobody, except the king, need know. "How high do you suppose it is?" she said aloud as she danced. The king looked up at the moon.
"At least a mile, I should think,"
said he. The red cow nodded. She thought so too. For a moment she considered, and then she made up her mind.
"I never thought that I should come to this, Your Majesty, jumping, and over the moon at that. But I'll try it,"
she said, and curtsied gracefully to the throne.
"Good!"
said the king pleasantly, realizing that he would be in time for the barber after all. "Follow me." He led the way into the garden, and the red cow and the courtiers followed him.
"Now," said the king when he reached the open lawn, "when I blow the whistle, jump."
He took a large golden whistle from his waistcoat pocket and blew into it lightly to make sure there was no dust in it. The red cow danced at attention.
"Now, one," said the king. "Two, three."
Then he blew the whistle. The red cow, drawing in her breath, gave one huge, tremendous jump, and the earth fell away beneath her. She could see the figures of the king and the courtiers growing smaller and smaller until they disappeared below. She herself shot upwards through the sky, with the stars spinning around her like great golden plates. And presently, in blinding light, she felt the cold rays of the moon upon her. She shut her eyes as she went over it, and as the dazzling gleam passed behind her and she bent her head towards the earth again, she felt the star slip down her horn. With a great rush, it fell off and went rolling down the sky, and it seemed to her that as it disappeared into the darkness, great chords of music came from it and echoed through the air. In another minute, the red cow had landed on the earth again. To her great surprise, she found that she was not in the king's garden, but in her own dandelion field. And she had stopped dancing. Her feet were as steady as though they were made of stone, and she walked as sedately as any other respectable cow. Quietly and serenely, she moved across the field, beheading her golden soldiers as she went to greet the red calf. "I'm so glad you're back," said the red calf. "I've been so lonely." The red cow kissed it and fell to munching the meadow. It was her first good meal for a week, and by the time her hunger was satisfied, she had eaten up several regiments. After that, she felt better. She soon began to live her life just exactly as she had lived it before. At first, she enjoyed her quiet, regular habits very much, and was glad to be able to eat her breakfast without dancing, and to lie down in the grass and sleep at night instead of curtsying to the moon until the morning. But after a little, she began to feel uncomfortable and dissatisfied. Her dandelion field and her red calf were all very well, but she wanted something else, and she couldn't think what it was. At last, she realized that she was missing her star. She had grown so used to dancing, and to the happy feeling the star had given her, that she wanted to do a sailor's hornpipe and to have the star on her horn again. She fretted, she lost her appetite, her temper was atrocious, and she frequently burst into tears for no reason at all. Eventually, she went to my mother and told her the whole story and asked her advice. "Good gracious, my dear," my mother said to her, "you don't suppose that only one star ever fell out of the sky? Billions fall every night, I'm told. But they fall in different places, of course. You can't expect two stars to drop in the same field in one lifetime." "Then you think if I moved about a bit," the red cow began, a happy, eager look coming into her eyes. "If it were me," said my mother, "I'd go and look for one." "I will," said the red cow joyously. "I will indeed." Mary Poppins paused. "And that, I suppose, is why she was walking down Cherry Tree Lane," Jane prompted gently. "Yes," whispered Michael, "she was looking for her star." Mary Poppins sat up with a little start. The intent look had gone from her eyes and the stillness from her body. "Come down from that window at once, sir," she said crossly. "I am going to turn on the lights." And she hurried across the landing to the electric light switch. "Michael," said Jane in a careful whisper, "just have one look and see if the cow's still there." Hurriedly, Michael peered out through the gathering dusk. "Quickly," said Jane. "Mary Poppins will be back in 1 minute. Can you see her?" "No," said Michael, staring out. "Not a sign of her. She's gone." "Oh, I do hope she finds it," said Jane, thinking of the red cow roaming through the world looking for a star to stick on her horn. "So do I," said Michael, as, at the sound of Mary Poppins's returning footsteps, he hurriedly pulled down the blind. Chapter 6 Bad Tuesday. It was not very long afterwards that Michael woke up one morning with a curious feeling inside him.
He knew, the moment he opened his eyes, that something was wrong, but he was not quite sure what it was.
"What is today, Mary Poppins?" he inquired, pushing the bedclothes away from him.
"Tuesday," said Mary Poppins. "Go and turn on your bath. Hurry," she said, as he made no effort to move. He turned over and pulled the bedclothes up over his head, and the curious feeling increased.
"What did I say?" said Mary Poppins, in that cold, clear voice that was always a warning.
Michael knew now what was happening to him. He knew he was going to be naughty.
"I won't," he said slowly, his voice muffled by the blanket.
Mary Poppins twitched the clothes from his hand and looked down upon him.
"I won't."
He waited, wondering what she would do, and was surprised when, without a word, she went into the bathroom and turned on the tap herself. He took his towel and went slowly in as she came out, and for the first time in his life, Michael entirely bathed himself. He knew by this that he was in disgrace, and he purposely neglected to wash behind his ears.
"Shall I let out the water?"
he inquired in the rudest voice he had. There was no reply.
"Pooh, I don't care," said Michael, and the hot, heavy weight that was within him swelled and grew larger. "I don't care."
He dressed himself then, putting on his best clothes that he knew were only for Sunday. And after that, he went downstairs, kicking the banisters with his feet, a thing he knew he should not do as it waked up everybody else in the house. On the stairs he met Ellen, the housemaid, and as he passed her, he knocked the hot water jug out of her hand.
"Well, you are a clumsy," said Ellen, as she bent down to mop up the water. "That was for your father's shaving."
"I meant to," said Michael calmly.
Ellen's red face went quite white with surprise. "Meant to? You meant? Well, then you're a very bad heathen boy, and I'll tell your ma so I will."
"Do," said Michael, and he went on down the stairs.
Well, that was the beginning of it. Throughout the rest of the day, nothing went right with him.
The hot, heavy feeling inside him made him do the most awful things, and as soon as he'd done them, he felt extraordinarily pleased and glad, and thought out some more at once. In the kitchen, Mrs. Brill, the cook, was making scones.
"No, Master Michael," she said, "you can't scrape out the basin. It's not empty yet."
And at that, he let out his foot and kicked Mrs. Brill very hard on the shin, so that she dropped the rolling pin and screamed aloud.
"You kicked Mrs. Brill? Kind Mrs. Brill? I'm ashamed of you," said his mother a few minutes later when Mrs. Brill had told her the whole story. "You must beg her pardon at once. Say you're sorry, Michael."
"But I'm not sorry, I'm glad. Her legs are too fat," he said, and before they could catch him, he ran away up the area steps and into the garden. There he purposely bumped into Robertson Eye, who was sound asleep on top of the best rock plants, and Robertson Eye was very angry.
"I'll tell your pa," he said threateningly.
"And I'll tell him you haven't cleaned the shoes this morning," said Michael, and was a little astonished at himself. It was his habit and Jane's always to protect Robertson Eye, because they loved him and didn't want to lose him. But he was not astonished for long, for he had begun to wonder what he could do next, and it was no time before he thought of something. Through the bars of the fence he could see Miss Lark's Andrew daintily sniffing at the next-door lawn and choosing for himself the best blades of grass. He called softly to Andrew and gave him a biscuit out of his own pocket, and while Andrew was munching it he tied Andrew's tail to the fence with a piece of string. Then he ran away with Miss Lark's angry, outraged voice screaming in his ears and his body almost bursting with the exciting weight of that heavy thing inside of him. The door of his father's study stood open, for Ellen had just been dusting the books, so Michael did a forbidden thing. He went in, sat down at his father's desk, and with his father's pen began to scribble on the blotter. Suddenly his elbow, knocking against the inkpot, upset it, and the chair and the desk and the quill pen and his own best clothes were covered with great spreading stains of blue ink. It looked dreadful, and fear of what would happen to him stirred within Michael. But in spite of that, he didn't care. He didn't feel the least bit sorry.
"That child must be ill," said Mrs. Banks when she was told by Ellen, who suddenly returned and discovered him of the latest adventure. "Michael, you shall have some syrup of figs."
"I'm not ill. I'm weller than you," said Michael rudely.
"Then you're simply naughty," said his mother, "and you shall be punished." And sure enough, 5 minutes later, Michael found himself standing in his stained clothes in a corner of the nursery, facing the wall. Jane tried to speak to him when Mary Poppins was not looking, but he would not answer, and put out his tongue at her. When John and Barbara crawled along the floor, and each took hold of one of his shoes and gurgled, he just pushed them roughly away, and all the time he was enjoying his badness, hugging it to him as though it were a friend, and not caring a bit. "I hate being good," he said aloud to himself as he trailed after Mary Poppins and Jane and the perambulator on the afternoon walk to the park. "Don't dawdle," said Mary Poppins, looking back at him. But he went on dawdling and dragging the sides of his shoes along the pavement in order to scratch the leather. Suddenly, Mary Poppins turned and faced him, one hand on the handle of the perambulator. "You," she began, "got out of bed the wrong side this morning."
"I didn't," said Michael. "There is no wrong side to my bed."
"Every bed has a right and a wrong side," said Mary Poppins primly.
"Not mine. It's next to the wall."
"That makes no difference. It's still a side," scoffed Mary Poppins.
"Well, is the wrong side the left side, or is the wrong side the right side? Because I got out on the right side, so how can it be wrong?"
"Both sides were the wrong side this morning, Mr. Smarty."
"But it has only one, and if I got out the right side," he argued.
"One word more from you," began Mary Poppins, and she said it in such a peculiarly threatening voice that even Michael felt a little nervous. "One more word and I'll..."
She did not say what she would do, but he quickened his pace.
"Pull yourself together, Michael," said Jane in a whisper.
"You shut up," he said, but so low that Mary Poppins could not hear.
"Now, sir," said Mary Poppins, "off you go in front of me, please. I'm not going to have you stravaguing behind any longer. You'll oblige me by going on ahead."
She pushed him in front of her, and, she continued, "there's a shiny thing sparkling on the path just along there. I'll thank you to go and pick it up and bring it to me. Somebody's dropped their tiara, perhaps." Against his will, but because he didn't dare not to, Michael looked in the direction in which she was pointing. Yes, there was something shining on the path. From that distance it looked very interesting, and its sparkling rays of light seemed to beckon him. He walked on, swaggering a little, going as slowly as he dared, and pretending that he didn't really want to see what it was. He reached the spot, and stooping, picked up the shining thing. It was a small, round sort of box, with a glass top, and on the glass an arrow marked. Inside, a round disc that seemed to be covered with letters swung gently as he moved the box. Jane ran up and looked at it over his shoulder. "What is it, Michael?" she asked.
"I won't tell you," said Michael, though he didn't know himself.
"Mary Poppins, what is it?" demanded Jane, as the perambulator drew up beside them. Mary Poppins took the little box from Michael's hand.
"It's mine," he said jealously.
"No, mine," said Mary Poppins. "I saw it first."
"But I picked it up."
He tried to snatch it from her hand, but she gave him such a look that his hand fell to his side. She tilted the round thing backwards and forwards, and in the sunlight the disc and its letters went careering madly inside the box.
"What's it for?" asked Jane.
"To go around the world with," said Mary Poppins.
"Pooh," said Michael. "You go round the world in a ship or an aeroplane, I know that. The box thing wouldn't take you round the world."
"Oh, indeed, wouldn't it?" said Mary Poppins, with a curious I-know-better-than-you expression on her face.
"You just watch."
And holding the compass in her hand, she turned towards the entrance of the park and said the word North. The letters slid round the arrow, dancing giddily. Suddenly, the atmosphere seemed to grow bitterly cold, and the wind became so icy that Jane and Michael shut their eyes against it. When they opened them, the park had entirely disappeared. Not a tree, nor a green painted seat, nor an asphalt footpath was in sight. Instead, they were surrounded by great boulders of blue ice, and beneath their feet snow lay thickly frosted upon the ground.
"Oh,
Oh! Cried Jane, shivering with cold and surprise, and she rushed to cover the twins with their perambulator rug. What has happened to us?
Mary Poppins sniffed. She had no time to reply, however, for at that moment a white furry head peered cautiously round a boulder. Then a huge polar bear leapt out and, standing on his hind legs, proceeded to hug Mary Poppins.
"I was afraid you might be trappers," he said. "Welcome to the North Pole, all of you."
He put out a long pink tongue, rough and warm as a bath towel, and gently licked the children's cheeks. They trembled. Did polar bears eat children, they wondered.
"You're shivering," the bear said kindly. "That's because you need something to eat. Make yourselves comfortable on this iceberg." He waved a paw at a block of ice. "Now, what would you like? Cod? Shrimps? Just something to keep the wolf from the door?"
"I'm afraid we can't stay," Mary Poppins broke in. "We're on our way round the world."
"Well, do let me get you a little snack. It won't take me a jiffy."
He sprang into the blue-green water and came up with a herring.
"I wish you could have stayed for a chat."
He tucked the fish into Mary Poppins's hand.
"I long for a bit of gossip."
"Another time, perhaps," she said, "and thank you for the fish." "South," she said to the compass. It seemed to Jane and Michael then that the world was spinning round them. As they felt the air getting soft and warm, they found themselves in a leafy jungle from which came a noisy sound of squawking.
"Welcome!" shrieked a large hyacinth macaw, who was perched on a branch with outstretched wings. "You're just the person we need, Mary Poppins! My wife's off gadding, and I'm left to sit on the eggs! Do take a turn! There's a good girl! I need a little rest!"
He lifted a spread wing cautiously, disclosing a nest with two white eggs.
"Alas, this is just a passing visit. We're on our way round the world." "Gracious, what a journey! Well, stay for a little moment so that I can get some sleep. If you can look after all those creatures," he nodded at the children, "you can keep two small eggs warm. Do, Mary Poppins, and I'll get you some bananas instead of that wriggling fish."
"It was a present," said Mary Poppins.
"Well, well, keep it if you must. But what madness to go gallivanting round the world when you could stay and bring up our nestlings. Why should we spend our time sitting when you could do it as well?"
"Better, you mean," sniffed Mary Poppins. Then, to Jane and Michael's disappointment, they would dearly have liked some tropical fruit. She shook her head decisively and said, "East." Again the world went spinning round them. Or were they spinning round the world? And then, whichever it was, ceased. They found themselves in a grassy clearing surrounded by bamboo trees. Green, paper-like leaves rustled in the breeze, and above that quiet swishing they could hear a steady rhythmic sound, a snore, or was it a purr? Glancing round, they beheld a large, furry shape, black with blotches of white. Or was it white with blotches of black? They could not really be sure. Jane and Michael gazed at each other. Was it a dream from which they would wake, or were they seeing, of all things, a panda? And a panda in its own home, and not behind bars in a zoo. The dream, if it was a dream, drew a long breath.
"Whoever it is, please go away. I rest in the afternoon."
The voice was as furry as the rest of him.
"Very well, then we will go away, and then perhaps..."
Mary Poppins's voice was at its most priggish. "You'll be sorry you missed us." The panda opened one black eye.
"Oh, it's you, my dear girl," he said sleepily. "Why not just let me know you were coming? Difficult though it would have been, for you I would have stayed awake."
The furry shape yawned and stretched itself.
"Ah, well. I'll have to make a home for you all. There won't be enough room in mine."
He nodded at a neat shelter made of leaves and bamboo sticks.
"But," he added, eyeing the herring, I will not allow that scaly sea thing under any roof of mine. Fishes are far too fishy for me.
We shall not be staying, Mary Poppins assured him. We're taking a little trip round the world and just looked in for a moment.
What nonsense!
The panda gave an enormous yawn.
Traipsing wildly round the world when you could stay here with me. Never mind, my dear Mary. You always do what you want to do, however absurd and foolish. Pluck a few young bamboo shoots. They'll sustain you till you get home. And you too.
He nodded at Jane and Michael.
Tickle me gently behind the ears. That always sends me to sleep.
Eagerly, they sat down beside him and stroked the silky fur. Never again, they were sure of it, would they have the chance of stroking a panda. The furry shape settled itself, and as they stroked, the snore, or the purr, began its rhythm. He's asleep, said Mary Poppins softly. We mustn't wake him again. She beckoned to the children, and as they came on tiptoe towards her, she gave a flick of her wrist, and the compass apparently understood, for the spinning began again. Hills and lakes, mountains and forests went waltzing round them to unheard music. Then again the world was still, as if it had never moved. This time they found themselves on a long white shore, with wavelets lapping and curling against it. And immediately before them was a cloud of whirling, swirling sand, from which came a series of grunts. Then slowly the cloud settled, disclosing a large black and grey dolphin with a young one at her side. "Is that you, Amelia?" called Mary Poppins. The dolphin blew some sand from her nose and gave a start of surprise.
"Well, of all people, it's Mary Poppins, you were just in time to share our sand bath. Nothing like a sand bath for cleansing the fins and the tail."
"I had a bath this morning, thank you."
"Well, what about those young ones, dear? Couldn't they do with a bit of scouring?"
"They have no fins and tails," said Mary Poppins, much to the children's disappointment. They would have liked to roll in the sand.
"Well, what on earth or sea are you doing here?" Amelia demanded briskly.
"Oh, just going round the world, you know," Mary Poppins said airily, as though going round the world was a thing you did every day.
"Well, it's a treat for Froggy and me, isn't it, Froggy?"
Amelia butted him with her nose, and the young dolphin gave a friendly squeak.
"I call him Froggy because he so often strays away, just like the frog that would a wooing go, whether his mother would let him or no. Don't you, Froggy?"
Her answer was another squeak.
"Well, now for a meal. What would you like?" Amelia grinned at Jane and Michael, displaying a splendid array of teeth. "There's cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh, and the seaweed here is excellent."
"Thank you kindly, I'm sure, Amelia, but we have to be home in half a minute." Mary Poppins laid a firm hand on the handle of the perambulator. Amelia was clearly disappointed.
"Whatever kind of visit is that? Hello and goodbye in the same breath. Next time you must stay for tea, and we'll all sit together on a rock and sing a song to the moon. Hey, Froggy?"
Froggy squeaked. "That will be lovely," said Mary Poppins, and Jane and Michael echoed her words. They had never yet sat on a rock and sung a song to the moon.
"Well, au revoir, one and all. By the way, Mary, my dear, were you going to take that herring with you?"
Amelia greedily eyed the fish, which, fearing the worst was about to happen, made itself as limp as it could in Mary Poppins' hand.
"No, I'm planning to throw it back to the sea,"
the herring gasped with relief.
"A very proper decision, Mary," Amelia toothily smiled. "We get so few of them in these parts, and they make a delicious meal. Why don't we race for it? Froggy and me, when you say go, we'll start swimming and see who gets it first."
Mary Poppins held the fish aloft. "Ready, steady, go," she cried. And as if it were bird rather than fish, the herring swooped up and splashed into the sea. The dolphins were after it in a second, two dark, striving shapes rippling through the water. Jane and Michael could hardly breathe. Which would win the prize, or would the prize escape?
Froggy, 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 yelled Michael. If the herring had to be caught and eaten, he wanted Froggy to win. Froggy! The wind and the sea both cried the name, but Michael's voice was the stronger.
What do you think you're doing, Michael?
Mary Poppins sounded ferocious. He glanced at her for a moment and turned again to the sea. But the sea was not there. Nothing but a neat green lawn. Jane agog beside him, the twins in the perambulator, and Mary Poppins pushing it in the middle of the park.
Jumping up and down and shouting, making a nuisance of yourself. One would think you'd done enough for one day. Step along at once, please.
Round the world, and back in a minute. What a wonderful box, said Jane.
It's a compass, not a box, and it's mine, said Michael. I found it. Give it to me.
My compass, thank you, said Mary Poppins as she slipped it into her pocket.
He looked as if he would like to kill her, but he shrugged his shoulders and stalked off, taking no notice of anyone. The burning weight still hung heavily within him. After the adventure with the compass, it seemed to grow worse, and towards the evening he grew naughtier and naughtier. He pinched the twins when Mary Poppins was not looking, and when they cried, he said in a falsely kind voice, "Why, darlings, what is the matter?" But Mary Poppins was not deceived by it.
"You've got something coming to you," she said significantly, but the burning thing inside him would not let him care. He just shrugged his shoulders and pulled Jane's hair, and after that he went to the supper table and upset his bread and milk.
"And that," said Mary Poppins, "is the end. Such deliberate naughtiness I never saw in all my born days. I never did, and that's a fact. Off you go. Straight into bed with you, and not another word."
He had never seen her look so terrible. But still, he didn't care. He went into the night nursery and undressed. No, he didn't care. He was bad, and if they didn't look out, he'd be worse. He didn't care. He hated everybody. If they weren't careful, he would run away and join a circus. There, off went a button. Good. There would be fewer to do up in the morning. And another, all the better. Nothing in all the world could ever make him feel sorry. He would get into bed without brushing his hair or his teeth, certainly without saying his prayers. He was just about to get into bed, and indeed had one foot already in it, when he noticed the compass lying on top of the chest of drawers. Very slowly, he withdrew his foot and tiptoed across the room. He knew now what he would do. He would take the compass and spin it and go round the world, and they'd never find him again, and it would serve them right. Without making a sound, he lifted a chair and put it against the chest of drawers. Then he climbed up on it and took the compass in his hand. He moved it. North, south, east, west, he said very quickly, in case anybody should come in before he got well away. A noise behind the chair startled him, and he turned round guiltily, expecting to see Mary Poppins. But instead, there were four gigantic figures bearing down upon him. The bear with his fangs showing, the macaw fiercely flapping his wings, the panda with his fur on end, the dolphin thrusting out her snout. From all quarters of the room, they were rushing upon him, their shadows huge on the ceiling. No longer kind and friendly, they were now full of revenge. Their terrible, angry faces loomed nearer. He could feel their hot breath on his face. "Oh, oh!" Michael dropped the compass. "Mary Poppins, help me!" he screamed. And shut his eyes in terror. And then something enveloped him. The great creatures in their greater shadows, with a mingled roar or squawk of triumph, flung themselves upon him. What was it that held him soft and warm in its smothering embrace? The polar bear's fur coat, the macaw's feathers, the panda's fur he had stroked so gently, the mother dolphin's flipper? And what was he, or it might be she, planning to do to him? If only he had been good. If only... "Mary Poppins!" he wailed as he felt himself carried through the air and set down in something still softer. "Oh, dear! Mary Poppins!"
All right, I'm not deaf, I'm thankful to say. No need to shout," he heard her saying calmly. He opened one eye. He could see no sign of the four gigantic figures of the compass. He opened the other eye to make sure. No, not a glint of any of them. He sat up. He looked round the room. There was nothing there. Then he discovered that the soft thing that was round him was his own blanket, and the soft thing he was lying on was his own bed. And, oh, the heavy burning thing that had been inside him all day had melted and disappeared. He
He felt peaceful and happy, and as if he would like to give everybody he knew a birthday present.
What happened?
He said rather anxiously to Mary Poppins.
I told you that was my compass, didn't I? Be kind enough not to touch my things, if you please, was all she said as she stooped and picked up the compass and put it in her pocket. Then she began to fold the clothes that he had thrown down on the floor.
Shall I do it? He said.
No, thank you.
He watched her go into the next room, and presently she returned and put something warm into his hands. It was a cup of milk. Michael sipped it, tasting every drop several times with his tongue, making it last as long as possible so that Mary Poppins should stay beside him. She stood there without saying a word, watching the milk slowly disappear. He could smell her crackling white apron and the faint flavour of toast that always hung about her so deliciously. But try as he would, he could not make the milk last forever. And presently, with a sigh of regret, he handed her the empty cup and slipped down into the bed. He had never known it be so comfortable, he thought. And he thought, too, how warm he was, and how happy he felt, and how lucky he was to be alive.
"Isn't it a funny thing, Mary Poppins?" he said drowsily. "I've been so very naughty, and I feel so very good."
"Hm," said Mary Poppins as she tucked him in and went away to wash up the supper things.
Chapter 7 The Bird Woman.
"Perhaps she won't be there," said Michael. "Yes, she will," said Jane. "She's always there, forever and ever."
They were walking up Ludgate Hill on the way to pay a visit to Mr. Banks in the city, for he had said that morning to Mrs. Banks,
"My dear, if it doesn't rain, I think Jane and Michael might call for me at the office today. That is, if you are agreeable. I have a feeling I should like to be taken to tea and shortbread fingers, and it's not often I have a treat." And Mrs. Banks had said she would think about it.
But all day long, though Jane and Michael had watched her anxiously, she had not seemed to be thinking about it at all. From the things she said, she was thinking about the laundry bill and Michael's new overcoat and where was Aunt Flossie's address and why did that wretched Mrs. Jackson ask her to tea on the second Thursday of the month when she knew that was the very day Mrs. Banks had to go to the dentist's. Suddenly, when they felt quite sure she would never think about Mr. Banks's treat, she said, "Now, children, don't stand staring at me like that. Get your things on. You're going to the city to have tea with your father. Had you forgotten?" As if they could have forgotten, for it was not as though it were only the tea that mattered. There was also the bird woman, and she herself was the best of all treats.